You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. I'm Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to this event on mobile innovation in Africa. And we are webcasting this event live, so we'd like to welcome our viewers from around the country and around the world. And we will be archiving this video, so anyone who would like to watch this after today will have an opportunity to do so. It will be archived at the brookings.edu website. And we'd also welcome any comments or questions that you have online. We have set up a Twitter feed at hashtag MHealthAfrica. That's MHealthAfrica. So feel free to post any comments or questions that you have during the forum. And during our Q&A, we will take questions both from our virtual as well as our live audience here in the auditorium. So in recent weeks, I've been reading a number of newspaper stories about kind of trumpeting the success of the fight against Ebola. There have been a number of stories kind of noting the fact that we're actually down to very few cases of Ebola, even in Africa. And we all remember last fall the situation where we all were panicked and there were a rising number of cases, and it looked like this really was reaching epidemic proportions. But virtually none of the newspaper articles have talked about the role that mobile technology played in dealing with Ebola and contributing to healthcare in general in some of these African countries. And this puzzles me because yesterday we put out a paper reporting on some of the research that we've done on the topic. And we found that mobile devices actually played a major role in fighting Ebola and improving outcomes in maternal care as well as in other areas in Africa. So in the paper, we talk about some of the mobile applications that help to train frontline health workers, that help to reduce the gap between rural and urban areas, and then also brought critical information regarding both diagnosis and treatment. Some of these innovations in mHealth improve the efficiency and the effectiveness of medical systems. They help keep track of patients, provided medical records for these individuals, and also aided in the reporting process to public health authorities. So in many different respects, these technologies provided crucial information for treating the epidemic and addressing many of the important societal health issues that have developed. It's, I think, one of the reasons why the world was able to deal effectively with Ebola. The mobile piece of the story is something we all should appreciate. In order to help us understand the power of mobile technology, we have brought together a number of distinguished experts here today. To make opening remarks, we are pleased to welcome Nate Tibbetts to Brookings. Nate is the Senior Vice President of Government Affairs for Qualcomm Incorporated. And in that position, he's responsible for the company's DC office and its work on public affairs and public policy. Prior to joining Qualcomm, Nate served as Executive Secretary of the White House National Security Council. And fitting with our focus today on Africa, Nate actually grew up in Lesotho and spent considerable time there in college. In the 1990s, he also spent 5 years working at the National Democratic Institute on election monitoring and democracy training, and spent time in Ghana, Malawi, Namibia, and South Africa. So please join me in welcoming Nate to Brookings.
Good morning. Thanks, Daryl, for the warm welcome. Our general counsel, Don Rosenberg, was going to be here today and unfortunately couldn't make it, so I'm his fill-in, but I'm really delighted to be here. I'd like to thank the Brookings Institution for hosting this event today, and to our panelists and for their commitment and dedication to research in the field of mobile health. For over 3 years, Qualcomm has collaborated with Brookings, and we've had the privilege of working in partnership to explore the positive social and economic impact of mobile technology around the world. Qualcomm, for those of you who might not be familiar, is a global leader in wireless technology. Our technologies and chipsets can be found in many of the mobile devices you have with you today. Our innovations in technology enable billions of people across the world to access mobile broadband. We're able to do this because our dedication to research and development and our business model allow us to license our intellectual property and reinvest a significant portion of that revenue back into R&D. This commitment of approximately $34 billion cumulatively over our 30-year history helps us work on new ideas and innovation. Increased access to mobile technology encourages growth in the broader economy of a nation. A recent study of six countries by the Boston Consulting Group showed that mobile is contributing more than $1.2 trillion in GDP from those six countries alone, which is a massive amount. It empowers businesses and people, connecting them rapidly to a global market, enhancing the flow of information and improving access to healthcare. When Qualcomm was founded, no one could have predicted the transformative effect that wireless technology could have had in healthcare and so many areas of our lives. I'm really honored to be here today to have this opportunity to share with you how Qualcomm sees mobile technology transforming access to healthcare globally. Through advanced wireless technology, it's possible to connect the world's frontline health workers to critical job support tools, ultimately improving public health outcomes. This is critical because frontline health workers are the first and often only link to healthcare for millions of people living in the developing world. According to the World Health Organization, developing countries face a healthcare work crisis, with 57 countries in need of trained healthcare workers. Currently, just 1% of the world's population provides healthcare services to more than 7 billion people on Earth, most of whom live in developing countries. At the same time, approximately half of the world's population are expected to become mobile internet users by 2020. This growth is expected to come from developing countries, where most people will be accessing the internet for the first time through a mobile connection. In Africa alone, the total number of mobile broadband subscriptions is expected to grow 7 times, from just over 105 million in 2013 to 805 million in 2018, which is an amazing and dramatic increase. To Qualcomm, these data points reveal an unprecedented opportunity to leverage the benefits of advanced wireless technologies and mobile tools to address some of the world's pressing healthcare challenges. Mobile technologies can help healthcare providers in emerging regions to access the latest professional development tools, provide interactive job aids, and assist in supervisory support, helping lower costs and increase efficiencies, and ultimately improve healthcare outcomes. mHealth services are already transforming healthcare as we know it. They ensure that people living in developing parts of the world, both rural and remote areas, have better access to frontline health workers, medical services, and information they need to help them lead healthier and more productive lives. mHealth has the potential to dramatically alter the landscape for how healthcare services are accessed and delivered, especially in emergency situations. In the case of infectious disease outbreaks like the recent Ebola crisis, advanced wireless tools and platforms can provide immediate, preventive, and sometimes life-saving solutions. During today's panel, you'll hear more about a successful maternal health project in Nigeria that has inspired new forms of use for the mobile platform that focuses on the training and tracking of Ebola outbreaks. Additionally, we know that governments are facing increased healthcare costs due to a myriad of issues, including increased incidence of communicable and chronic diseases, as well as large demographic shifts in aging populations. Mobile can reduce costs by allowing for remote monitoring of chronic diseases while allowing patients to age in place. Mobile can also improve efficiencies in public health and serve as a mechanism to extend the reach of doctors and frontline health workers. For example, imagine you're a patient experiencing symptoms related to your cardiovascular health, and you live hundreds or maybe even thousands of miles from a heart specialist. Now imagine being able to hold in your hand a mobile phone with a built-in electrocardiograph sensor, and in less than a minute have the mobile device read your heart data, transmit it to a cardiac specialist who can then provide diagnosis, consultation, and treatment remotely. Mobile isn't just a game changer for heart health. It's also positively impacting treatment for other critical or chronic conditions like diabetes and HIV. This is just one of the examples of the sort of innovation that demonstrate how mobile technologies can improve and change access to healthcare. The program that I've just described is an example of work being done in China by Qualcomm Wireless Reach, which is our initiative that works to demonstrate innovative uses of wireless technology. With over 100 projects in 40 countries, the goal of Wireless Reach is to create projects that leverage wireless technology to strengthen economic and social development with a focus on education, entrepreneurship, the environment, public safety, and in particular, healthcare. We believe that mobile broadband is a well-suited solution for mobile health education, capacity building, and maternal and child health, and health crises, of course. Today, you'll hear directly from some of our Wireless Reach partners who are doing very important work in West Africa. It's been a privilege to collaborate with them on a maternal and child healthcare project and explore how mobile technologies can have a long-term impact on patient health. You'll also hear how these technologies support policymakers' efforts to achieve Millennium Development Goals set by the United Nations to improve maternal health and reduce child mortality. Nigeria suffers from one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, approximately 630 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. And in fact, in some midwife service centers, that number is even higher, at close to 1,000. In comparison, the maternal death rate in developed countries is 16 per 100,000 births. In addition, this maternal health project in Nigeria is quickly adapted to disseminate critical information and education to curb the spread of Ebola and prepare frontline health workers for any contact with the disease. The adaptability of the technology to address an acute healthcare crisis is invaluable, and we're fortunate to hear firsthand about how this exciting work has unfolded from today's panelists. Qualcomm's belief that access to mobile technologies can improve people's lives is at the core of what we do every day. At Qualcomm, we are working to imagine the possibilities, envision success, and invent new solutions. Eventually, mHealth will just be healthcare, and Qualcomm's technology will be part of the global connectivity fabric, powering transitional care, chronic care, and connected therapy management solutions. The effect of mobile technology on healthcare in Nigeria and worldwide, sometimes in global health crises, is undeniable. But our work is not done, and unfortunately, numerous barriers continue to inhibit the ability to create today's and tomorrow's life-changing health inventions. It's crucially important for inventors to have the ability to realize the benefit of their creations, their intellectual property. The revenue generated by these types of inventions fuels virtuous cycles of R&D-based innovation that lead to future discoveries and treatments and cures. The expansion of mobile broadband services also depend on a government's ability to provide access to spectrum and continuous investment in mobile communications infrastructure. Certain policies and regulations are crucial to encouraging global development in support of every nation's priorities. Government regulation and policy has a significant impact on encouraging development and access to all that mobile technology and devices enable. We must keep in mind that here in the United States and around the world, the incredible innovations we hear about today are possible thanks to these fundamental policies and regulations that exist today. It is our hope that Qualcomm's inventions, as well as the tangible examples made possible through our Wireless Reach program, will demonstrate, inspire, and ultimately extend health resources to frontline health workers globally, providing people with unparalleled access to care. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Nate, for those remarks and also your leadership in the sector as a whole. So we're pleased to have several individuals who are at the forefront of mHealth innovation, especially as it relates to Ebola and maternal care. All these individuals have worked at the front lines in West Africa in several different countries, so we're going to draw on their expertise today. So we're pleased to welcome Deborah Theobald. She is co-founder, chairwoman, and chief executive officer of Vecna Technologies. That sounds like three full-time jobs there, maybe more. She co-founded Vecna in 1998 and provides strategic vision, executes tactical directives, and designs the next generation of product solutions. She also serves as the executive director of Vecna Cares, which is the nonprofit arm of the company supporting initiatives in Africa. Among other things, that organization has the goal of improving quality and access to healthcare, as well as supporting local technology programs in K-12 schools. We also have OK Akuzo, who's the founder and CEO of Instrait Global Health Solutions. He founded this firm in 2009 and focuses on global health innovation. He helps to identify and deploy technology-based healthcare solutions to underserved markets using SMS and 3G wireless technologies. He also spent 10 years at Pfizer with responsibilities including finance, planning, and business development, and then also joined Novartis Pharmaceuticals as the Director of Strategy and Innovation. Dr. Ocean is the Deputy Project Director of the Subsidy Reinvestment and Empowerment Program for Maternal and Child Health in Nigeria. From 2011, he served as Senior Technical Assistant to the Minister of State for Health at Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Health and was part of the ministerial team that organized the Saving 1 Million Lives initiative. He also has led the development and implementation of Nigeria's country implementation plan for the United Nations Commission on Life-Saving Commodities for Women and Children. So I want to start with Deborah and just ask if you can tell us about Vecna Technologies and your interest in mobile health solutions.
Sure. So Vecna Technologies was founded in 1999, and it is a healthcare information technology and robotics company. So we've been providing healthcare solutions to first world healthcare for about 17 years now. In 2009, well, most of our products and services focus on interoperability and automation within these areas with most of our customers are government and private, so we service the Veterans Administration as well as large healthcare systems. So we're very understanding of health information systems in these healthcare facilities across the country and in many different types of areas. But in 2009, I became aware of global health through several different circumstances and acquaintances. And as I began to understand the challenges of data collection and analysis for global health programs, started to see how much need there was for quality information. And just some basic, simple, streamlined tools put into place, how they could have a very large impact. So we started to take a look at what the barriers were in 2009 for implementing these types of systems. And I even took the opportunity myself to go and live over there in these countries and to understand what these actual projects were, not just for 2 or 3 weeks, but for the next 8 or 9 months as how we were implementing these types of systems and what kind of barriers came up about that. It was very interesting for me to see some of the wastelands of technology projects that have been tried to be implemented before and why they happened and where. And then to try to understand how we could start to implement new systems. So obviously the first barriers that we came up against were your infrastructure barriers of power and computers and low IT literacy and also infrastructure network or IT services. So if you're going to be doing electronic data collection, you're going to have electronics. And how do we support that? So we took some of our hardware expertise and put that to play in these areas and created our Clinipac And after five iterations, we have now a single box that helps to put together all of those power management, computing, inverter, and wireless needs, local wireless, and also internet connectivity into one box. And then we also took on the electronic medical record aspect of it. How do you create streamlined software tools that can really help people and be adopted easily? And then we've also been working now with projects such as these to look at what the implementation factors are. What are the methodologies that can really make these successful? So I think from a Vecna Vecna Cares point of view, this has been wonderful for us to transition our technology into use around the world and to incorporate that with other open source technologies and other commodities that can really transform the gathering of information. Because information is power, power to understand the issues that are at hand, power to communicate those issues and those needs, and power to change, to allocate those resources effectively and do the most with the resources that we have at hand.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, you founded InStrate Global Health Solutions and helped to deploy healthcare solutions in underserved markets. So how is your company using mobile solutions and data analytics?
First, thanks very much for that introduction, Daryl. And thanks very much to everyone who took the time to be here with us this morning and to everyone who's on the live webcast. So I started InStrate in 2009, and the premise was that emerging health technologies, especially mobile health, give us a unique opportunity to overcome the barriers that have impeded healthcare delivery in places like Africa, and also to give us a new approach or a new platform for healthcare delivery. And since then, we have tried a number of different technology platforms and have settled on three. The three platforms that we're currently working on are SMS technologies or text messaging for remote patient monitoring for chronic disease patients. We've been offering that in Nigeria since 2011. We also work with hospital. We provide hospital management systems that have electronic health records components. And the third platform is working with Vecna to promote and implement Clinipac in Nigeria. And I'd like to just recognize the fact that we started in 2013 with a pre-pilot in two health facilities, outside of the federal capital territory in Nigeria, and we are now in 51, healthcare facilities. And along the way, we have put in place operating procedures, learnings, and experiences that position us pretty effectively, I would say, to scale this platform more broadly. And we look forward to having some of those conversations with you this morning. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So Dr. Oshun, you've served in Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Health, so can you tell us about your background and responsibilities?
Thank you. Although I'm a doctor by training, I think I have more of a development background because of my master's degree in poverty reduction. And the last 15 years, I've worked in Nigeria in various capacities for agencies, international and local. About 3 years ago, I responded to the call to serve my country, and I joined the Ministry of Health to really just offer assistance in transforming our health sector. I think we had some achievements. One was we shifted the focus from inputs and processes of building structures, training into outcomes and results. And therefore, we framed a narrative of let's save a million lives in response to our poor health indices. Now, in framing that narrative of saving a million lives, we developed a program called the Subsidy Reimbursement Empowerment Program for Maternal and Child Health, which got funded by the presidency to $500 million over 4 years. And what we did was to set up supply and demand side interventions of deploying frontline healthcare workers to rural areas in the country, mobilizing women to access services by cash transfer incentives, and also addressing the key bottlenecks of commodity stockouts and data reporting and data management. So part of my responsibility was to see how we can leverage on efficiencies and technology like mobile health solutions to basically drive performance and deliver results for our people. So I sit on three committees. One is a mobile cash transfer committee that basically disburses cash to women by their mobile phones. Two is I'm now a steering committee member for the Mama Nigeria Partnership, which is the Mobile Alliance for Maternal Action, in partnership with USAID, Johnson & Johnson, and some other key players. And three is just basically using mHealth to improve reporting for government, so we can use the data to inform decision-making and policies.
Okay, so let's talk about the Ebola crisis. So each of you have worked in various African countries, places such as Nigeria, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, among other places. I'll throw this out for each of you, and each of you can respond in kind. What role did mobile play in fighting Ebola? Maybe we'll start with Debbie.
So the Ebola crisis was something that took people by surprise, and that in some cases we were looking around to see what tools we had that would make an impact here. And it was interesting for us as a project and as a consortium to take a look at what are our resources to help work with this crisis. And among this project, we had two great opportunities, and I'll actually let OK talk to one of them that we did, that we built upon our Clinipac system that he was saying is out in, 50 clinics right now. We have a baseline infrastructure of digital health records and electronic communication with frontline staff workers. That's been hugely positive, and that we put into practice with some Ebola outreach for them. And so having that health system infrastructure already in place that we could tap into and access all of those people immediately was a very good place for us to start, and something that I wish that we had more access and more spread among the clinics so that we could have reached more people at this point. So I think the investment in the health systems infrastructure before these crises start was really impactful. Another thing that I was personally involved in that we received funding through this grant was to take our Clinipac system to Sierra Leone and Liberia and to put it into actual Ebola treatment units. And so our hardware component of this was unique in that the box, the Clinipac that we have created, was able to overcome a lot of these infrastructure barriers that were creating a lot of havoc for clinical healthcare workers in these Ebola treatment units, these ETUs. We were able to take the Clinipac and set it up within the green zone in these Ebola treatment units. And basically you plug it into power into a car battery, 12-volt car battery, and turn it on. And from there you have a server, a wireless network, and your software that can be accessed by tablets within the range of this local wireless network. And that range included the green zone and the isolation zones. And so healthcare workers within the isolation zones were able to use tablets that were designated for these suspected cases and confirmed cases wards and document care within those wards. And then that information was available to everyone throughout. The problem that this was solving is that anything that goes into these red zones cannot come out, including paper. And so people were documenting care within these care zones, and they had no way of getting that out. And so, again, we were able to take this technology that had been used within these health systems for basic primary care, for basic maternal child health services, and we were able to rapidly deploy them for these emergency responses. So I think having this foresight of investing in these technologies that are really for health system strengthening and for empowerment of these electronic data capture and sharing can be used very quickly in some of these responses.
Thanks for that, Debbie. And so in how we used it in Nigeria, just really demonstrates the versatility of this platform. And so as Debbie referenced, the investments that were made in creating this platform really paid off in this instance, because Nigeria was suddenly faced with the potential for a major crisis in Ebola. And so what we did on our team was to sit back and brainstorm about what we could do, given the technologies that we had, and just a moral obligation to try to extend that to help people avoid this catastrophe. And so let me just create the scene for you, and that is that, we are working with healthcare workers in remote places, and in some of the places that we're working in, there is no power, there is no portable water, right? And somehow we're still able to put in, electronic health data collection mechanisms. And so people in those communities don't have much access to communication. And so as this Ebola was became real, people didn't have all the information that you have about what it is, how to prevent it, what your personal risk was. And so these frontline health workers had that risk. Secondly, given the ignorance that they had around this disease, they also bore the other risk of if there was a potential, somebody got sick, they would end up at the healthcare center and interact with people who didn't have much more information than them. And so what we figured was that we have a unique opportunity, given that we're working with these frontline health workers, to leverage Clinipac to very quickly disseminate information on Ebola. And so I'd like to recognize the participation, the partnership, and the leadership of the Ondo State government in Nigeria, on this effort. And so what we did was we, within 3 days, had developed and we're ready to push out an Ebola awareness tutorial that was specifically designed for the consumption and the understanding of frontline health workers. It took a little bit longer than 3 days for the government to approve the dissemination of that material. But once it was ready, we pushed the material out. Before we did that, actually, we did a baseline survey of frontline health workers to assess the knowledge and attitudes of frontline health workers towards Ebola. And then we did this tutorial. And after the tutorial, which was viewed by over 1,000 people, 1,000 frontline health workers, and I should mention that anecdotally, we understand that each frontline health worker that's educated on subjects such as these influences or educates at least 4 other workers around them. So by touching over 1,000, we're able to touch over 4,000 or educate over 4,000 health workers. And so after the tutorial, we then did a post-tutorial assessment of these same workers that did the pre-tutorial assessment, read the tutorial. And I'm just pleased to announce that on all the indices that we measured, we achieved significant increases in the knowledge by an 11% increase in frontline health worker knowledge on Ebola. And on other behavioral attributes, things like the common sense things, it's, you know, how often do you wash your hands? How often do you wash the surfaces that you work within? How often do you make contact with people who have been diagnosed, or things like, is Ebola a spiritual spiritual phenomenon? And on all of these, we're able to achieve anywhere between 6% and on the low end and 39% growth in a shift in attitudes towards this disease. And so we felt that with this project, we were able to significantly shift frontline healthcare workers towards knowledge and attitudes towards Ebola virus disease. And I should also add that a very heartwarming experience that we had was when we heard from multiple people, multiple frontline health workers who were in these distant, remote healthcare facilities who had minimal interaction with the center, with the Ministry of Health, and minimal communications with the Ministry of Health. When we pushed this, we heard that the fact that somebody cared enough about them to send these tutorials to help them get better educated, to help them be prepared for this outbreak, signal to them that somebody cares about their well-being. And so that was a really, really, good impact of this project. And the other thing that fortunately was not used, I say fortunately because in Nigeria, the Ebola was very quickly brought under control was the fact that we also were able to deploy, put in place an Ebola management algorithm that stepped healthcare workers through very simple questions, all the way from a patient presenting with a suspicious, symptoms, all the way down to isolate and notify the National Ebola Response Authorities. And I say fortunately that it wasn't used because it was brought under control, but we're pretty confident that if a patient presented in any one of these facilities, any one of the health workers that had ClinPack would very quickly know exactly what to do with this patient. And I might add that that is probably more than a number of institutions, even here in the U.S., could boast of at the time. Thank you.
And I'll come from a different perspective to what OK and Debbie have said. We look at the Ebola response in Nigeria, and why were we so successful? Because we probably saw it from four different perspectives. One was the patient or the client. So we used the increasing mobile penetration of the country to ensure that we could pass across messages to people, wherever they were, through their mobile phones. Two is what they've talked about, the healthcare workers, empowering them with information on how to manage patients and also on how to protect themselves and probably help with education. Three is the health system support, which they've talked about. But the last thing was there was this emergency operational center, which basically was set up to ensure that we could reach out to 36 states through mobile technology, and contact tracking, contact reporting, and being able to just deploy resources and manage resources efficiently from just one center. All of this was based on the fact that there was a mobile platform that was available and that was deployable throughout the country. And I think all of those things together really helped us in generating a very rapid response and control.
So another question for each of the three of you. What benefits did you find, and also what barriers did you overcome, and how did you overcome them? Debbie?
In the Ebola response?
Yes.
So the barriers that I'll start with that. The technology is not usually the barrier to some of these projects. In fact, sometimes the technology can be quite simplistic. But the real thing is how to implement and to overcome necessarily the attitudes or the systems with which the technology is going to be deployed. So when we are looking at a particular response to a crisis, who is it that's getting involved? So for example, the group that we worked with actually over in Liberia is called the International Rescue Committee, IRC. And they were very free in telling us that this was a big risk for them to take an electronic medical record over and deploy for this type of response. It's unproven. Nobody else is doing it. They felt like they were going out on a limb. So a lot of people view technology as something that they can't place a lot of confidence in, something that's going to turn around and bite them, and maybe because it has in the past. So technology can be a very temperamental friend or foe, depending on what side of the battle that you're on. And this is me coming from owning a technology company. Sometimes it's your greatest asset, and the other times you just want to throw it out the window. So when we deployed to, when we took it over to Liberia, there were a lot of people who stood back and wanted to watch and say, how is this going to work? Is this really going to happen? Can you really do what you say you're going to do? Is this really going to be easy enough? Are the doctors really going to accept this? And the nurses, we have people coming from all over the world who are going to be using this, and we don't have a lot of time to train. It's a very stressful environment, and we wear three gloves on one hand and touching the tablets and things. And there were a lot of logistical barriers to overcome and attitudes and things that that were very interesting to me to start to understand. So we've worked a lot with health systems in putting this in place for primary care and for maternal child health and such. And so I felt like we understood a lot of what we were coming up against as far as health care worker concerns and some of the methodology for having the in-charges all on board and the all of the authorities up the chain on board before we put this system in, and making sure that it was really working into the ecosystem of, you know, what was already there. But when you're coming into an evolving ecosystem, where people don't even really know what the clinical protocols are, maybe they're changing every day, and the doctor that was here yesterday has now gone home and there's a new shift of people coming in, and how are we going to manage all of that? That was a very interesting thing for us. What was critical is that we had a platform that was very configurable and that we could change things rapidly on the fly. So we got a call, you know, in the beginning of October, and we left the day before Thanksgiving to go out. So that was a very short time period in which we had to gather all the requirements for patient flow, for clinical protocols, for medications that would be there, and load all of those into our system and allow that to be as easy as possible for people who are in these, you know, very hot, very sweaty environments, covered in personal protective gear from head to foot, goggles, masks, gloves, and then trying to use an electronic tablet. I mean, you can imagine that would be very stressful. And not only, you know, using the tablet to document care, but that's, you know, that's the side note. What I'm actually doing is giving care. And so how do I make this, you know, easy enough for people to have confidence in, to take in with them, and to feel like it's not going to hold them back from doing what their real mission is. And so I think when we looked at the barriers and what we had to overcome with that type of an implementation, you know, luckily we had a platform that was able to overcome some of the, you know, fundamentals. So, you know, power and the infrastructure and all of that, we didn't have to worry about. That was already taken care of. So we could focus on the important things of, you know, how are we triaging a patient? How is that patient going from here to here? Who's taking them? What questions are they going to ask? What's the easiest way for us to ask those and get that information into the system? What are the protocols? How do we make it easier to track what the patient has received over these last couple of days and communicate that to the entire staff? What are the reports that you need to have? You know, the snapshots of who's in, what their state is, and those types of things. We were able to build that out very quickly on this platform, and then to go and to train people within a day while we were there. And then the next day, they were training their staff. And to then have the staff and the trainers feel confident about using that system when they're going into these high-risk areas to give care. So when you think about implementing a technology system or a solution in response to these, the technology hopefully is something that's, you know, a grounding facilitator to all of these other moving parts and helps to bring all those together.
Yeah, so thanks, Debbie. I think, you know, I agree with everything Debbie said, and she's, you know, she's covered most of the barriers. What I'd like to just focus on is the human factor. And I think Debbie alluded to that when she said that the technology is the easy part. And fortunately for us, we have gotten the technology to the point where it's invisible. If you want to pull up the today's weather, you really don't care how many satellites your phone is hitting. It's you touch that icon and the weather comes up. You pull up a map. Somebody calls you. The technology is invisible so long as it works. And so we're fortunate to have gotten we're getting to the point where the technology is becoming invisible. And so what then that starts to spotlight is the human factor. And the human factor is evident because, you know, we're talking about bringing people from it's a paradigm shift. People are working in a different paradigm currently in the past than the paradigm we're trying to push them towards. And so you have everything from disbelief to resistance to ignorance to just you have, you know, the whole gamut. And there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to every one of these issues. And there's also not a one-size-fits-all approach to every single person. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to every single situation. So we have to, you know, very quickly identify the human factor as an issue and very quickly figure out how to overcome that human factor. So I will just illustrate with a couple of anecdotes. So we train healthcare, frontline health workers, And within 30 minutes, people who have never touched a tablet computer or a smartphone are able to use the tablet computer within 30 minutes. That's phenomenal. And then we go away, and we're looking at the data. We're looking at the reports coming in, and they're sending up the data every day, and it's all working well, and we're like, hey. And then next month, we go back, and they say, well, we really don't want to continue this. And somebody says, why? Because it's not my job to type, capture data on a tablet computer. Okay, fine. This is the same thing as paper. It's just a different form. Well, my boss didn't tell me that. Okay, let's tell your boss to tell you that. The boss says, well, it's not the organizational policy to capture it. And then before you know, you have to go up right to the very top, and the government has to set up a policy to capture data electronically. And so you see how this human factor very quickly becomes a national policy issue. Or you have a decision maker who all of his life, you know, their discipline has been to make decisions based on gut. It's not their fault. It's because they haven't had the data, or the data that they've had has been reliable. And so their training, right, and their very their professional discipline has been to rely on their instincts. And then suddenly you provide fancy charts and say, make your decision. And the guy is looking at this, and it goes counter to his entire professional orientation. And so we need to recognize that there is a process through which you bring people, you know, from this, you know, you help them work through this paradigm shift. And that is the most difficult, in my experience, the most challenging, because there are just too many different pieces. Everybody responds differently. And so you have to identify, you have to figure out how to overcome it. In some cases, we have gone to places and we have said, please, please, please just do this because it helps us. Or do this because it helps you. Or, you know, if you do this, you won't spend a week at the end of the month tallying your reports, you know. Or we have actually, in some instances, developed PowerPoint analysis with the analysis to the potential outcomes and the decisions. And we say, here are the decisions that you need to make. All you need to do is say yes. You know, so I think that without overstating it, I think that the human factor is a significant barrier that we're going to keep hitting on for a very long time. And in terms of the benefits, it's just, and I think you asked about the benefits as well, correct? But it's just the fact that we are enabling things that have not been done, you know, before. So, you know, I'll give you a couple of examples as well. So the data that we're providing has enabled us to highlight service delivery gaps. And so you have a bureaucrat at the Ministry of Health who has 5,000 facilities under his oversight and has instituted programs that are supposed to be implemented identically in every single one of 5,000 facilities. And unfortunately, he does not have the data coming back to him reporting on how each one of those facilities is implementing these programs. And so he then sits back and assumes that it's working exactly the way he instructed. Now, we all know that it is never the case, even here in the U.S. Now, we're able to provide data, you know, that comes back to him and says, well, you draw a curve. Here are the outliers. Here are the people who are doing it really, really well. And you need to, they have practices that you need to communicate and you need to emulate. And then you have people that are not even doing it. And so when we provide this data, they've seen that there are service gaps that they need to fill. And what are those service gaps? They have to institute, whether it's delivering vaccines to some facilities or putting in additional staff in other facilities. So we've been able to directly impact that. You know, another anecdote, and I have, you know, literally I can spend 3 hours giving you anecdotes, but another one is, where you have, they can do demand capacity planning. So if you have women who have pregnant women who have gone through antenatal 1, 2, 3, and 4, the fourth antenatal visit, you can pretty much tell that over the next month or so, there will be deliveries. And so if we give you a report that in this month you had 300 antenatal 4 visits, perhaps you can plan for 300 deliveries. And so what does that mean? Skilled birth attendants that can handle 300 deliveries. It's the facilities, it's the medication, it's the vaccines, the zero vaccines for the infants right after they've been delivered. And so they're able to do better demand capacity planning because we're providing data. And I think, I know that this is translating to better health care for the patients and better healthcare outcomes. In time, we will document the impact on maternal mortality, but we are contributing to it right now. Thank you.
I'll say one word, and that is responding to change. I think typically we've run a paper-based system for disease reporting, notification, and every other thing. And with this this new opportunity to use mobile health solutions, we still have to navigate the policy changes for healthcare workers to be allowed to stop paper reporting and using the mobile system. Secondly, there is a reporting trail that goes up to the federal level that requires submission of paper reports every month. Now, with the Clearing Pack, we can actually get our reports from the cloud. But that might not be accepted by authorities because it's not coming in from the conventional forms with the brand of the Ministry of Health, and all the work. So I think for us that's been a key barrier. And what we are doing now is really just engaging a community of practice to begin to think through all the policy, legal, regulatory requirements that we need to give us the environment to really like maximize the potentials that we have for mobile solutions.
Okay, I'm going to ask one last question, then we can open the floor to questions and comments from you. And this is, what are the lessons for other countries? Each of you have kind of given a rich description of what you did, what some of the benefits were, some of the barriers that you were able to overcome. Based on all this, what are the lessons for other countries? Organizational routines, addressing the human factor, public policy suggestions, changes in the legal or regulatory structure. What are your thoughts?
You'd like me to go first again?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you've done such a great job on the last two questions.
Good. Well, I get to get all the good points in first. So I'll take it from a data perspective. So something about mHealth that I see as a big opportunity now that we have all of these new innovative platforms that are out there is how do we bring those all into something that's more substantive? So don't think of it as an mHealth program that you're putting into place to solve one consolidated or targeted focused problem. That may be the case, but how does it fit into the larger information ecosystem that you're creating within the country? So what we're trying to do is establish an information infrastructure, something that feeds into, it is a mobile health platform that then feeds into a patient record. So we are capturing patient-centric data to a patient record. So every time somebody fills out a point of care survey about a care that they've just given, so they've documented that care experience and it goes up into the cloud, we take that and we match it up to the patient and we continue on a longitudinal record about the care that person has received over the course of the whole episode of care, which may be a pregnancy, a delivery, and then even on into the child's life of immunization and care throughout that. And so what that means is it's not just, and this is interesting because we've gone places and the frontline workers have said, this is a really interesting program. Who is this for? And we say it's for you. This is for you to have for your operations, for your programs. This is not a researcher coming in. This is not an NGO saying, I want to know about this or know about this. Let me take your data and these results, and then we'll come back and give you another program to do. This is about what care are you giving right now? What barriers are you facing right now? Let's understand the public health system, the midwives and the patients that they're seeing right now. And let's put that into a record that will stay. Let's put this into a program that is meant to stay forever. And so one of the things that we really focus on as Vecna Cares is how can we make tools that integrate into this ecosystem? So like Dr. Ocean said, we want to integrate into the DHIS too. We're working on that actively now. We want to be involved with the policies and the decisions that are making so that this is a program that can be used every day within these clinics. And it sets the baseline and the foundation. I mean, what's different from this program from many other programs? When you look at it from the surface, maybe not much. We're capturing data on patient care. But how we look at this is, no, we're laying a foundation for other programs to come in on top of, to build. So if this is a highway, okay, it's a one-lane highway, but it's paved. And it's there, and now you have it, and people can use it for maternal child health data. But our next initiative this year is to put primary care on top of that. So why are midwives in this part of the clinic using tablets to capture their data, and the clinicians over here are using paper to capture, you know, primary care, outpatient care? So we are combining then the entire clinic, the entire healthcare data capture to get onto this infrastructure and to be patient-centric so that you're not just getting aggregate numbers at the high levels to say, well, we distributed 50,000 immunizations. And you say, to who? Who were those? What was the outcome of the birth and then and the mother all the way through prenatal care and then to the immunization? How many of these children received all of their immunizations, and what are the same factors between those children or the children who didn't get them all, and how do we then learn from that and then put interventions on top of this baseline? And so then you have metrics that can be compared and managed with quality, and you can get the conclusions that you're drawing from that data, you can have the confidence in, or at least you can know with confidence what the limitations on those were. Instead of having, you know, a myriad of questions around them that you can't even answer. So we're really excited about this project and laying that foundation and looking at that in a long-term perspective. And we're really grateful for our partners for working with us on that vision.
Happy that you get to go first. You know, again, you know, I agree with everything you've said. And, to add to that, I think that, we can't underestimate the impact of what we're doing. It is a big deal. And we're instituting change. And people, naturally, most people are uncomfortable with change or resistant to change. And so, there's enough inertia in technology adoption, in of itself. And then when it comes to changing the way you work, changing the way you interact with patients, it just makes people uncomfortable. And so there's resistance and there's inertia that we have to overcome. In our experience, it's been more effective where there's top-down buy-in, where somebody says, you have to do this, right? If that decision's been made and it's been communicated down the line, it is our job to foster the buy-in bottom-up. We have mechanisms to do that, and we have done that effectively, but the forces that we have to come up against are that much more powerful if there's not the top-down support, because we're swimming against the tide the whole way. And so where we have, whether it's the head Ministry of Health, the head of the program communicating down, saying that this is a new way of working and we would like to embrace it. We need to embrace it. This is your job. We have to do it now, right? It really helps people feel comfortable in embracing that change. And, you know, and then, you know, in that process, we then have to start to put in the, you know, change management, you know, processes, you know, to get people comfortable with taking risks and making mistakes and not feeling like, you know, the very serious consequences if they make mistakes and, you know, all the good, you know, change management 101 type stuff. But I think that if you are able to, you know, at a policy level, you know, just get that top-down, you know, top-down directive, you know, it really makes the work a lot easier. And that is direct experience, because we've been able to, we've had the opportunity to work in contexts where we've worked bottom up, and in contexts where we've had that top down buy-in, and it's been significantly more effective when it's top down.
Okay. I go last. So I have
that means you can correct any mistakes that they have made.
Okay. So I have three lessons to share with other countries. One is, no matter how good the technology is, it needs to respond to problems and needs to offer compelling solutions. So, for instance, when we had the Clean Park experience in Nigeria, we had our own service delivery protocols and formats, and they had to basically come back and begin to retweak and to re-engineer. So I would say that from the onset, the solutions just need to respond to specific problems, and that's where the value added comes in. Number two is we had to set up what we call a committee of practice. So that brought together policymakers, programmers, the tech people, the mobile network operators, and everybody that is involved in the ICT field and health sector come together to meet, to begin to like work out what should be our roadmap for translating from where we are to the mobile system where it's now going to be nationally owned and accepted. And I think the key thing, the third lesson is to always from the onset think about going to scale, because typically we start programs from a pilot mentality and let's do it small, and then we spend resources on keeping it small, and then to now translate to that big leap, it's like, wow. So I think I'm taking a step back now. I would say that have a vision for scale from day one, and then have a roadmap for how do we begin to hit those milestones to take it to that next step.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions from you. If you can give us your name and your, yep, right there. And there's a microphone coming up. If you can hold on just until I give you the microphone. Our webcast audience can hear your question.
Dixon Ogwang from the Embassy of Uganda in Washington, D.C. This has been a very interesting discussion and understanding of how mobile technology can be used to improve healthcare. My question goes to the panel in regard to the local person in Africa. Deep down in the village, how do you envision the mobile technology? How do you think it's going to affect them positively? How are we going to reach that local person in the village, rural community? My desire has been here waiting to hear how we're going to really benefit the local man with the invention of this new innovation. Thank you.
Great question. Anyone want to respond to that?
I'll go first.
Okay, yeah, you go first.
I like your question. In Nigeria, we think no matter where you are in the country, most people now have access to a mobile phone. Right? So that's good. I'll give you an example of what we're trying to do now. We noticed that we have more mortality for women and children in rural areas compared to urban areas. So, and that was why we focused our programs on working in rural areas. But we need to actually generate demand, and you need to empower women with education about the key ANC messages for maternal health and for child health. So what we are doing now is working on an alliance with MAMA, which is basically using the mobile phones to give content to new and expectant mothers, so that's one. And I think that platform also serves to give content on so many other key messages for health. I mean, people are, you know, get text messages on marketing for different things by their mobile phones. The second thing we've done in Nigeria is we launched a program last year called Money for My Phone. So we're disbursing cash to women for the cash transfer program through the mobile phone. So the woman qualifies for like maybe $30 for having 4 NCV seats, kids by delivery and immunization. She's verified that she's completed the program, and she gets a text message which she can go to a mobile agent and cash down rather than coming to get a cash disbursement. So we are reaching women in rural areas to the mobile phone for that. And I think the third is,
I'll go off of that. So with the cash disbursements to mothers who, so there is a protocol that WHO has endorsed that is able to improve outcomes for mothers, right, for expectant mothers. And that is 4 ANC visits and an attended birth. And so what Dr. Ocean is picking up on is that, and the program for cash transfer, conditional cash transfer, is that if women complete that that protocol, that they will have money given to them. And so what is the documentation for that care? And so we're looking at how we can work into that program to provide that documentation for that care. And so when you come in and you have a visit and it's documented through this electronic system, then it automatically generates a report of who has that conditional cash transfer, is it eligible for that conditional cash transfer. And then possibly through our data capture. So as a caregiver is working with a patient, right? So a mother comes in and a caregiver is there with the tablet and they're documenting care as they're sitting in front of them. And so when you document care and you say, what visit is this? And they say, visit 2, a message can pop up and say, let the person know that if they complete 2 more visits and a skilled birth, they will have the opportunity to have cash transfer. So this guides the caregiver in their interaction. Now, that's for participation in a certain program, but you could also have those messages pop up for any number of things. Let the woman know that her blood pressure is high or her iron is low and that she needs to be particularly careful about this. So we have this infrastructure in place. We already have some clinical support for that interaction between the caregiver and the patient embedded in our system. But there's even more and more that we can put on top of that. So when you talk about, you know, how is this benefiting somebody, you know, who's the people in the village, the people on the ground, you know, the normal people walking around in the country, this is giving better care to them at the point of care. It's allowing us to have better outreach to them and put in better programs for them.
Yeah, so thanks. And you know, so let me first start by saying that at least half of the health centers that we're working with or the communities that we're working in are exactly what you've described. They are places that are not on the national power grid. The question may come up, so how do we provide power for the tablets? We have portable solar power chargers. So they're in exactly the place, the place that you've just described. So how do you get enhanced care to that, you know, woman in that community? So let me give you a very quick example, and this is real. In one of the states that we're working, Ondo State, they have this program called the ABA Safe Motherhood Program. In that program, they have health rangers that go out to the communities and perform outreach. You know, they talk, you know, figure out how they're doing, you know, how the baby is doing, try to bring them into the healthcare system. Now, these people go blind. They go without the history. And so if you're able to arm that person with the patient's history, first of all, you are able to make that a much smarter visit because, you know, if there's 10 people on your list, you can say, well, these 3 people are compliant with everything and they've been coming in. So scratch that. You focus on these people and, oh, this person, make sure that you bring her to the nearest specialist hospital because she's high risk. Or that person, right, this is her history, this is what you need to counsel her on. So you make that interaction a much higher value interaction in that community that you've described. And that is, those are the communities that we're working, as Dr. Oshin said, the focus is on the rural communities because, you know, the urban communities have their issues, but there's a lot of resources being devoted. There's not nearly enough being devoted to the rural the rural areas.
Along the wall, gentleman over there.
Hi, I'm Arthur Allen from Politico. It's interesting that Brookings invited people from this one specific project. What I hear from people who work introducing technology in Africa is that the place, various countries are littered with great sounding projects that were abandoned after a few years. I was wondering if the participants could talk about what kinds of, it sounds like a wonderful project. I was wondering, how is it being sustained? What's the plan for sustaining it? How long is it being funded by Qualcomm? And then what's the plan after that ends?
You want to take that one?
Yeah. Okay, so I'll start. I think the difference with this project is it really wasn't donor-driven or initiated. It was in response to a government effort or initiative to improve health outcomes. So we see it more as a partnership, as a collaboration, one. The second is there's a footprint in the country. In Nigeria, we've done, analysis about different projects that have come in. Like you said, many of them basically just died out. One, because they did not really engage the right authorities, and two, there was no clear sense of where this was going to. So there's a vision that we want to improve health outcomes, not to save a million lives. We have a national committee of practice, actually, that is now embedded in the Ministry of Health. So there's an ongoing platform to continue the discussions. Where we are now is really just analyzing the results from this pilot phase to inform decision makers in the next political cycle, because that needs to go with evidence of efficiency and then value for money, where we can now begin to get it entrenched into having a budget line in the Ministry of Health to fund a continuous deployment of the program. And I think most programs don't go through that kind of rigorous system to ensure that it becomes government-owned and it's within the government's priorities. So I think that's where this is different. But Nigeria is a big country, and it is very unlikely that the government would alone fund a whole national scale, which is why the earlier we can share our results and seek for partnerships and collaborations based on people's interests to drive specific sections, then we can begin to see how everybody's contribution adds to that big scale of plan. So what we envision is to map out what scale would look like, what it would cost, and then now see how we can begin to get different elements to fund different sections.
So I'd like to come at that from two different angles. One is from the public-private partnership angle, and the second angle that I'm going to come at it is the social impact investment. So this has been successful because there's been a very strong public-private partnership involved in this. And the government has institutional programs and institutional knowledge. The private sector has the discipline and the execution experience and competence to drive those through the public institutional systems. And so, and of course, with the funding, we're able to do that and then prove the outcomes. And so that, and when you prove the outcomes, then, sometimes I get this question in Nigeria and I, come back to people and say, well, I remember a time when you had to stand for 3 hours to cash a check. Now you can pick up a basic phone and transfer money. If somebody ever told you to drop that system and go back to 3 hours, you would be up in arms. And so if we're able to prove program by program that these outcomes, the only way to these outcomes is through this system, then the sustainability is embedded in that value proposition, right? And so with social impact investment, INSTRAD, for example, is a for-profit company that's working within a social impact space that Qualcomm is funding. It is incumbent on me for my company's survival to prove those outcomes and to identify the sources of sustainable funding to keep those outcomes going. Otherwise, my company goes out of business.
And I'll just say from a IT company who's implementing systems, throughout the world, in first world healthcare and then in third world, is to say that we are employing industry techniques in this. And so when we take a look at this, we're taking a look at not from a research or program or other things, we're looking at it from an operational point of view. And so when we put a system in place, we're looking at adoption, data quality, data dashboards, these types of things, not necessarily from the clinical point of view will follow, but we want to say implementation, adoption, operationally, is this system getting us what we want? And I think that's been something that's very unique. We want to see that people are submitting their data, on time, and it's complete, and how many of the fields are filled out. And then we want to close that feedback loop back to the individuals who are taking that data. And then we want to set up the quality of that data. So we have very very clear methodologies that we are putting into a place and that we continue to challenge to see what kind of efficiencies we can gain from this. So where's the efficiencies we can gain in technology? Are there better things coming on the market? The tablets are commoditized. They're getting smaller. They're getting cheaper. Is there something else that's becoming even better to do this with? The solar power, overcoming the barriers. How do we make this more accessible to people? The methodologies of adoption or training or, data dashboards or feedback. Can we use Salesforce? Can we use other tools and incorporate them in so that we're not using people, that this is all automated? And so that feedback loop is automated. And so part of scale is, this initial capital investment and the people and the training and getting people to do the adoption. But eventually you're going to get to a steady state of, support. What's this cost to just keep it running? And we're trying to keep driving that down. What are the tools that we can bring in? What are the methodologies to make the sustainability less and less expensive?
Sorry, just one quick data point on that, on sustainability. One state government that we're working with has made a commitment that they're going to scale this across all the health centers in their state, and they're now working on how they're going to fund it. And they're talking, in that state, they have about 550 health facilities. It's not going to be all at the same time. It might be in chunks of 100 or 200, but they've made that commitment because they see this as a critical imperative to the vision of their healthcare delivery and the near-term vision of their healthcare delivery, by the way.
Okay, on the aisle, there.
Okay, Raylene Campbell with the Mobile Alliance for Maternal Action, MAMA. I kind of wanted to piggyback on that because my question was about cost savings. Obviously, MAMA is about the demand generation, making sure women go to their 4 antenatal visits and vaccinations and different practices and behavior across the continuum of care. But at the same side, listening to the Ebola conversation, MAMA can also be about demand mitigation and making sure that practices that can be adopted at the home, knowledge that can be acquired through mobile messaging can help bring down the number of visits and the burden on the healthcare workers at the front line. And I'm just curious, you were kind of alluding to the cost savings, but how each of you look at models for saving costs over the lifetime of the project and how that helps governments save costs in other areas in education of the healthcare workers and have this mobile approaches be more cost-effective ways of getting information to people and saving costs in other sides of government budgets, maybe.
Let me relay an experience we had. When we started the cash transfer program in Nigeria, there was a requirement for political visibility so that people could see that women were actually getting cash payments. So we'd convene what we call cash payout days, organize tents and chairs and refreshments, women would come down, sit down, be verified and be paid. And when the program grew to its 18 states, it was becoming a huge amount of money just to fund the system to pay the cash to the women. And that's why we moved into the mobile platform. Now, to move into the mobile cash transfer payments, we had to go through a process of convincing the directors, the audit people that, look, this is a more viable option. So what I did was we got in touch with the banks and the telcos, and we basically worked out the transactional cost for a mobile payment versus how much it costs to convene a physical cash disbursement day. And the value for money was clear. We're saving up to 6% on overhead costs by going to the mobile platform. So I think what we need to do for MCH and Ebola and other cases is to really begin to work out the maths So what do you currently expend on your current system as it is? And what would you expend if you're using a mobile solution or an approach? And once you have enough data points to put forth the policymakers, then it's a clear case and it's a no-brainer for there to be leadership to adopt.
Yes,
and
there's no... so it's been a while. I'm a little bit out of touch. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes, also on the aisle, there's a question.
Yeah, okay.
Hi, I am Amaka from a Nigerian think tank called the Center for Public Policy.
Alternatives.
It seems like you guys are all alluding to a very specific Vecna mobile platform that has been rolled out in Nigeria, and I understand it's called Clinipac. And I wasn't previously aware of it, so I'd really appreciate sort of more details about exactly who's using it. Is it just midwives? Where is it being used? Is it in community centers? Is it in, you know, government clinics? Is it in private clinics? Where exactly is the data going? Because somebody alluded to the idea of maybe the Ministry of Health is collecting data and using it. Is it going to the Ministry of Health? Is it going to state governments, local governments? Where exactly is it going, and how is it being used? You know, so it's kind of, especially in Nigeria, since most of you have that experience in Nigeria, I'd really like to learn more specifics. Thank you. Oh, and how is it being funded currently? I don't think we got an answer to that question. Thanks.
So it's being funded by Qualcomm. Okay. Thank you. and right now, in Nigeria, we're working in, since you want us to be specific, we're working in four states, Anambra, Kano, Ondo State, and the Federal Capital Territory. We're working all in three of the
that
states.
Was actually one
we're
of the
working.
Things I found most interesting about primary, when we saw the annexation of
someone talk
of
with
Crimea.
Our audio people and tell them to take care of this problem.
Russia has a very large stake in Ukrainian arms development, and for example, the number of transport
That's
planes.
That's probably a more interesting. I want to listen to that as well.
Was also that Ukraine, so, Ukrainian
and,
industries provide.
You know, so since I have the floor for the people on the live webcast, there is an audio interference from a different session that's going on that I believe has just been addressed. So we'll carry on. So we're working in these four states. We're working with SURP, the Subsidiary Investment Act, who has a maternal and child health program. In about half of our facilities, we're working with the National Primary Healthcare Development Agencies. In the other half, they have the midwife services scheme. In the other half, we're working with the Ondo State Ministry of Health. The data that we're capturing currently goes to the stakeholders. We send it to the SHORP leaders, the NPHCDA leaders. We send it to the Ondo State Ministry of Health. We're working, by the way, and then we send it also back to the facilities to populate the reports that they then submit up to the National Health Management Information System, which we're currently working to overcome by directly reporting our data from Clinipac into the National Health Management Information System. You asked quite a few questions. I'm not sure if I've addressed all of them.
I can say a little bit about Clinipac. So the Clinipac system that we're using in Nigeria is based off of an open source platform called ODK. And specifically, we're using a modification called ComCare, which was put together by another group called Damagi. And there are a lot of really fabulous tools out there. And so what we try to do as Vecna or Vecna Cares, the nonprofit arm of Vecna, is to consolidate these tools into one larger infrastructure or ecosystem. And what we're doing with that is taking some of the more user-friendly or the ones that fit the situations in which we're implementing and connect them into a larger infrastructure. And so we have a clinical database that the information from all of the clinics feeds into. So we're creating something of a master patient index. And then we're creating for each of those the documents of each of their interactions with the healthcare system. And so that's what feeds the aggregate data that gets pushed over to what OK was referred to as the DHIS-2 system, which is the national reporting system. So what that does, it takes patient information and aggregates it into just numbers and totals and pushes it over to that system is what we're achieving this year, instead of having to have that reporting system from the clinics. And then we also generate, we're actively generating data dashboards that we then distribute to our stakeholders. And we're refining those data dashboards, and that's what I was talking about with the automation of this. And I didn't get to address one of the things that you had brought up, which is also how do we drive down the cost efficiencies? What we really want to do is see how we're using the resources we have right now and how can we use them more efficiently. And so what we're doing is taking some of the, as Dr. Ocean was saying, of the change management and working together with policy, et cetera, and OK was saying that this is not my job. We're actually working together to make it people's jobs, right? So what is the medical records officer doing at the district level now? Well, now we have to train that person. And so, yes, there may be some investment in training and human capacity building, but we're actually working that into a system that's already there, that's already funded, that's already moving forward. So we're looking for opportunities like that where we can, again, set up this automation of this reporting and push it back to people, allow them to make better decisions with their resources. And this could be as far as, how many visits do we get to a center, and is it well-staffed? Or are there too many people for the visits that they have? And so to manage their human resources better. This could be like what OK referred to, you know, immunizations that are sent to various locations. If you can say, my refrigerator is down, don't send me immunizations, or vaccines, I'm sorry, then that's going to save a lot of vaccines from going bad. If you can say, we're up and running and we're having a lot of people coming in, then we can send you more. So having that communication infrastructure put into place is hopefully going to be something that we can show the impact of efficiency gains with the resources that are resident in the system.
Especially when you're now able to plan ahead.
Yeah, I think we have time just for one last question. There's this lady on the aisle right there. There's a microphone coming up right behind you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm president of an organization called Hope for Tomorrow. We are based here in Washington, D.C., and in the rural areas of Kenya, Western Kenya, in Kakamega. We just started a mobile applications, working with the government, as I commend you very much for what you said about human factor. There is always a very big barrier when it comes to government regulatory and licensing of frequencies. We almost 6 months looking at our frequency to apply education, healthcare, and entrepreneurship of rural areas of Kenya. So, what advantages or disadvantages did you get by getting the frequency and looking at what Tabora has just said? Communication. We have many organizations doing what you are doing, what I'm doing, but they don't know what each other is doing. So everybody's duplicating everything, don't know. So how do we get this information, getting a conference or an event in Africa, there in Kenya, where I come from, and call all these people to come and listen to what you are doing? The government is another headache, the people, and so we need all this collaboration and information to show what we are doing to the people, especially the rural areas who need more attention than the urban area. How do we collaborate and how do we come together to get to work together with your applications and my applications? Thank you.
Well, coming to this event is the first step on collaboration, so appreciate that.
We are also working in Kenya, and so I understand what it is that you're saying. And, because we do a lot of work in healthcare here in the United States, there are some pitfalls that we hope you will not fall into. And one of those pitfalls that we're suffering a lot from right now in the United States is interoperability. So the ability to exchange health information across facilities and, states or whatever. And one of the problems with that is that we have no standards, right? So we have no standards for the data, for how to transmit that data, of how that data is being stored. These are issues that will be popping up with you. And so it is not an intention to limit the innovation of technology to to end any of these successful programs that you have had. You should definitely continue to support them, and the tools that are working for you should continue to work for you. So it's not in limiting the amount of players in this space, but it's giving them a framework in which they can contribute to a health information ecosystem. And so if you have a mobile health program that is coming in, you need to understand what issue are they addressing, and how does that get, what piece is that playing into your larger system? So if, for example, us, we're addressing maternal child health within this subset of clinics, and we're feeding up into a larger system, then if we're setting up a master patient index or something that's patient-centric, we should be conforming to a standard of how that information gets transmitted back and forth and saved. And so when you have another group that's doing that same thing, they build it to that standard. And then we're able to combine those. So if you have something in the north or something in the south or southwest, then those can eventually come back all together. And so when you think about policies within your countries, don't think about it as saying you are an admitted vendor or an admitted technology or admitted this, because you may be hampering innovation. But instead say you must be able to transmit your data, share your data, conform to these standards, and then mandate that we all, you know, contribute to the DHIS too. That if you set up or adopt a national patient index or, you know, just individuals, that can be generalizable enough that people can feed into that. And then if there's specific program data that they're using on the ground in those areas, that those can be within their own format, but then the other data can be freely shared among all of these programs. So from a technical point of view, sorry if that was a little too deep for you, but or too technical into the weeds there. But we are very anxious to see the e-health policies become more of a standards policy so that we can avoid a lot of the headaches that will continue to plague the United States and first world healthcare for decades to come.
Well, it's been great to get the perspective from the front lines. Those of you who want more information, OK has a demonstration on a laptop, so you can come up afterwards and see what they're actually doing. But I want to thank Dr. Ocean, OK, and Debbie. It's a great innovation that each of you are doing, and we really appreciate your coming here to share your thoughts. So thank you very much.
Thank you.